Okay. So now, the Lord is described here. See, because first it's the goddess of fortune, and then here is how Zeroth, the goddess of fortune, then all his associates are the main focus, and now finally we focus in on the close-up shot, the Lord here. Was seen leaning favorably to his associates, his very sight intoxicating and attractive. He appeared to be very much satisfied for Sana. Smiling face decorated with an enchanting reddish hue. It's Aruna Lochana. His eyes are always described as Aruna means the rising sun, reddish like the rising sun. Reddish doesn't mean bloodshot eyes, but refers to the rims, I think, of the eyelids is reddish. Huh? Well, it doesn't say he's intoxicated. It says that the sight of his face is intoxicating. Balaram is different. He also has red eyes. But this Aruna Lochana is very characteristic. He's smiling, and his countenance says he's Aruna Lochana. Lochana's eyes. He was dressed in yellow cloth. And his chest is marked with the lines of the goddess of fortune.
That the feet, the gold of the gold testament, and the lines of the gold on the gold testament of the stone.
So here, what did you say?
There's a typo of his head at the end of the second last sentence should be capitalized.
Mm-hmm. It's the Lord, the God. Well, let me see the text here.
The divine
it is in his text.
Check it out.
Right.
Another one to send in to the. You're right. There's another typo.
Oh, another thing. How many of the typos in the actual book?
Huh?
The database is a whole other.
Yeah, right. Just don't talk about it. In the Padma Purana Uttarakhanda, there's a full description of the Yoga Pitta. Pitta means seat. Of course, this thing down the road is called the Yoga Pit around here. Joke pit, right? Joke pit.
What?
This is the actual word. Or the particular place where the Lord is in audience. It's a seat, but yoga, you know, for association, a connection with, where you go for an audience to his eternal devotees. And now, anticipating what we find out in the next verse, the personifications of religion, knowledge, opulence, and renunciation. The Vedas are there, personally to advise the Lord. He consults with the Rig Sarva, Atharva, and the Ayurveda as necessary. The 16 energies are there. Then they mentions the doorkeepers, three pairs of doorkeepers, and there are other doorkeepers. So you go out from the center, and there's all these are his parshavas, his associates like this. This is called the yogi.
What are the lines of the kind of support?
What are the lines, the marks of Sri on his chest? The Lord sometimes is described as a curl of white hair. Sri Vats. Sri Vatsa means the mark of Sri. Does the Lord's chest the rest place of the Goddess of Fortune, so she's represented there, and she's permanently there in this form. Okay. 17. Further description of the yoga. The Lord was seated on his throne and surrounded by different energies like the four, the 16, don't worry, the five, and the six natural opulences, along with other insignificant energies of the temporary character. But he was actually the Supreme Lord enjoying his own abode. He was indeed the Lord enjoying his own abode. Because here he is. So all of his potencies are serving the Lord in his abode in personified forms. So when it says the six natural opulences, that is to say, that's in this word up here called Bhaga, as in Bhagavan. Wealth, strength, fame, knowledge, beauty, and renunciation. So wealth is there, personified. Strength is there, personified. In someone who is the Lord of these particular characteristics, he's served by four. This is the four. This represents the principles of Prakriti, Purusha, Mahatattva, and ego, ahankara. So these are fundamental elements of creation that are there, also in personified form. See, I assume that ahankara is not somebody who's puffed up, personified. You know? When you say these things like this, but somehow or other, this is the person entity who is somehow or other the controller of that particular aspect of the material creation. They all have their personified forms. Because then the 16 are the other principles of other tattvas. Huh? The five elements. What do they call the Mahabhutas? Yeah, the Mahabhutas. The five, earth, water, fire, air, ether. And then the sense organs of the Ganendriya. Then the Karmendriya. And that makes 15 plus the mind, 16. Now the five include the sense objects. In other words, I think in the Panchamahabhuta are also the Panchatanmatras are included. You know these things that I'm talking about? The Tanmatras? Are you familiar with this? If you know, this is didn't we have it already? Did we go through this already? That's okay, I'll go through it again. Yeah, tanmatras are they call them the sense objects, but the sense objects are not, you know, this table is not a sense object, but the sense object would be hardness. The sense object would be color. The sense so these these they call tan mantras, which sort of means nothing but that, merely that. So they're the object of the senses. So the object of the sense of hearing is sound. The object of the sense of sight are forms and color. The object of touch, we don't have a word for that in English, but it's like hard, soft, heavy, light, smooth.
Texture.
Yeah, but there's more than texture, because texture is one of them, but the other is weight. The other is heat and cold. All of these are all the object of the sense of touch. Then there's the what did we talk about? Odors from the sense of smell and flavors from the sense of taste. So those are the senses. And then when you see anything, there's a bunch of them all combined together. And so those are the things that make up the creation. This is Sankhya philosophy. Kapila Sankhya 2. So all of these 25 items serve the Lord in material creation. So they're part of the material energy. And all of them are personally present to serve the Lord, even though we're in Vaikuntha. It's so interesting. Well, there it is. They are there. Although our pundit here tells me that different acharyas give different votes. Vishnu Chakravarti gives a whole a different list.
Well, that Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's list is part of it is what's quoted in the previous text.
Yeah, up there. Yeah. That's a little different. You notice that? Yeah.
He actually just equally. I just looked it now. He gives that list with whatever was the religion, knowledge, opulence, renunciation, forth, and then says in his commentary that Sridhar Swami's explanation, which is this one, mm-hmm. is also not unreasonable.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Then it mentions that he has some temporary insignificant energies of a temporary character. These here are the Asta cities, the yoga cities, attained by yogis for temporary overlordship. So when it says he was indeed the Lord enjoying in his own abode, he says he's naturally full with all such powers without any effort. They're his own powers. They're kind of inside him, but they're manifest outside, and therefore he is the Supreme Lord without any effort. They naturally belong to him. He's the only one like that. In the very beginning of Bhagavatam, let me just go and show you this statement if I can find it. In the very beginning of Bhagavatam, Prabhupada has a very striking sentence that's really, really worth looking at. And I think it's here. Listen to the first sentence. The conception of God and the conception of absolute truth are not on the same level. You know what he's talking about? The Srimad Bhagavatam hits on the target of the absolute truth. The conception of God indicates the controller, whereas the conception of the absolute truth indicates the summum bonum, or the ultimate source of all energies. There is no difference of opinion about the personal feature of God as the controller, because a controller cannot be impersonal. He has a little thing about modern government. It's always a person somewhere. So when in doubt, whenever we refer to controller over others, we must admit the existence of a personal feature. Because there are different controllers for different managerial positions, there may be many small gods. There are many vibhutimat sattvas, controllers or gods with various specific powers, but their absolute truth is one without a second. Srimad Bhagavatam designates the absolute truth or the summum bonum as the param satyam. So this is actually a really important idea, because when we're talking about Krishna, we're talking about the absolute truth. And the absolute truth means the ultimate, that from which everything comes. So in principle, there's only one. The idea of the absolute truth is one from which everything comes. The ultimate source of all energies. Whereas God, Ishwara, is just a powerful person. So in principle, there can be many gods. But there can be only one absolute truth. So, many people have the idea of God and they think of Krishna as God. But you don't really understand who he is until you understand that not only is he God or Ishwara, but he's also absolute truth, the ultimate source of all energies. If you think just Ishwara, you can have the idea that somehow or other I could get that position. You may think that Krishna just happens to be God. You know, he's just there by some kind of accident. But you have to understand that he's the absolute truth. He's the first, as Prabhupada says, he uses to say absolute truth, he uses this word Godhead. Which is, it comes from a German word, Gottheit, divinity. But it's used even in mystical literature to talk about some very transcendent idea of God. So he used the word Godhead, means the absolute truth, which, as we know, has three features: Brahman, Paramatman, Bhagavan. So Bhagavan is the personality of Godhead. Now, Godhead, it turns out there are many personalities of Godhead. All the Vishnu avatars, these are all personalities of Godhead. So Krishna is the supreme personality of Godhead. So this Prabhupada's a wonderful phrase. It's very exact. So if you understand that Krishna is the absolute truth, then you can understand he didn't, you know, get to that position. Anyway, he just eternally, forever was the absolute truth, and everything comes from him. Everything emanates from him. He's the natural possessor of all these powers. You see, Indra is a post. Somebody gets to be Indra. He stays in that post for a period of one manu, and then he has to step down, and another Indra, another person becomes the Indra. That's different. So Krishna didn't. That didn't happen. He wasn't appointed. He didn't lead a revolution and get the place. He can't be knocked down and replaced by anybody else. And he is the ultimate source of all energies. So this is a much more... So although he's both controller and absolute truth, we have to understand that Bhagavatam is really dedicated or focusing on this idea of the absolute truth. And so Prabhupada wants to say that they're not, these two conceptions are on different levels of understanding. And that's really, like, if you look at the theistic religions, you know, coming from the Middle East, there's really doesn't seem to be a very clear idea of absolute truth.
Yes.
And they said then he put up in the God. So the only God is to control him.
Yeah, yeah, right. He can be a little controller. I see little controllers everywhere, little gods, they're running around. I worked in an office once and there was this lady who controlled the supply closet. She was definitely a god. You had to worship her if you wanted a pencil.
So how does that say you're going to God?
Yeah, it's true. Prabhupada says everybody has to find a way to be God. You can't do anything, you purchase a dog, and now you're the God. This is your worshiper. So here is Krishna, so he's surrounded by these personalities, but they're his energies. There is his internal energy. Shri is there manifest with her associates, because they mentioned her associates are there. And that also among his associates are all his external energies. They're also there. So therefore he's the Lord. He's surrounded by all these energies. Yeah? Anything?
When it says the 25 items of the Lord, is that the 4, the 16, and the 5, not including the 6 differences? Is that what that is?
Yeah. No, the 16 plus 5 more. 21. Then he mentions the 4. Prakriti, Purusha, Mahatattva, and Ego, so that's 25.
So we're not including the 6 attributes?
No, that's another group. Yeah?
So, you mentioned the word Godhead.
Yeah.
I can wonder where that actually came from. Are you saying that this, the head that comes from the German word Heid, which refers to divinity?
Yeah, Heiden means ness in German. It's the English German equivalent of NESS. Huh?
Or toi,
yeah.
But that's kind of like signifying this absolute truth.
Yeah. Well, it came into English from Gottheit, it somehow became Godhead. But then everybody who speaks English always thinks of the word fountainhead, which is the source of a river. It's called a fountainhead, the spring from which a river. So you all, it sort of conveys this idea now. The source of all things, because of this analogy with the word fountainhead.
So that's what probably is
when he uses Godhead. When he uses Godhead, he means this, the entire absolute truth in all its aspects. Brahman, Paramatman, Bhagavan.
It's mentioning the goddess of fortune of Avalas. When you go down to South India, you often see the Lord with different consorts, Neo, Om,
yeah.
Shri.
Yeah.
I think there's three of them.
I think they're mentioned later on in this passage. They show up by name.
Okay.
Huh?
So he has how many wives does he have?
You cannot count.
Why? Anyway, down in South India, you see.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Later on in this chapter, they're mentioned.
Okay.
So it's okay in South India. So then he says, without any effort, he's the Supreme Lord. And then he says, goes on here how he's unlimitedly more powerful than any yogi, more learned than any jnani, richer than any wealthy person. No one is equal to or greater than him. No one can reach his level of perfection because he naturally has it. No penance. No yogic demonstrations. And any power that we have, Prabhupada said,
is borrowed from Krishna. Krishna owns all these things, and we borrow them from him. Now, yes?
I just found something in the commentary which sort of explained this reference to the other entities of the temporary character, and I realize that the Prabhupada is speaking of in the beginning of the second paragraph. This itaratra cha drulaihi, they say that means that these opulences of the Lord, in him they're eternal, but in others they're temporary.
They're temporary. Yeah.
And so that's why he says this, the living being by secret penance and performance of bodily exercises can temporarily attain something.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, he doesn't possess them temporarily.
Right.
But everybody else does. He gets them. Right. Okay, thank you. So, you know, when we came to this text today, this text 17, how it began, is it here that it begins this? You know, the one before that, it mentions that Brahma is seeing it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there it goes. Was seen.
The first text.
I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, it's text
15. 15, yeah. Dadarsha Brahma. Okay, when the goddess of fortune, he sees him here. So then now it actually says Brahma saw. So now it starts describing exactly what kind of close up in Brahma. Mentioned as having the point of view, and the personality of God was seen in this way. So this is his darshan of the Lord. And then again, we come down to 18. Tat darshana, by that audience of the Lord, by that darshan, thus seeing the personality of Godhead in his fullness, was overwhelmed with joy in his heart, and thus in full transcendental ecstasy, love and ecstasy, his eyes filled with tears of love, he thus bowed down before the Lord. That is the way of the highest perfection for the living being. So you see up in the Sanskrit, it's Paramahamsyena Patta, the path of the Paramahamsas. Path taken by the Paramahamsas. That is to say, the path that leads to this, the Paramahamsa Panta. So here, in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, it is stated that this great literature is meant for the Paramahamsas. This is the second verse, Paramahamsa. Paramo nirmatsaranam sitam, for those who are, you know, nirmatsara. Matsara means envy, which is Prabhupada here, who are free from all envy. And Prabhupada here translates as malice, hostility toward other living beings or anyone, any hostility. In this, that is to say, the Srimad Bhagavatam is meant for persons completely free from malice. In the conditioned life, the malicious life begins from the top, namely bearing malice against the Supreme Personality of God. We've discussed this point. So this is where it starts. The Prabhupada said earlier, the first sinful will of the living being is the desire to become the Lord. There's desire, why can't I be God? And then there's hate, why should Krishna be God? Why him and not me? We are constituted as the servant, but we somehow or other think that we can become the master. Everybody in the material world, the servants are always trying to become the master.
They're trying to overthrow the master, take his position, become him, rise up, be promoted, come to the top of the firm. They're acting that out here, but ultimately, when it comes to God, there's a class division that you cannot cross. This is what it says. In transcendence, there's two classes. Nitya, Nityanam, Chetanam, Chetananam. There's one class, is Nityaha, Chetanaha, singular. There's a set that only has one member. And then the other set is plural, Nityanam, Chetananam, genitive plural. There's one singular Nitya among many, many Nityas, one singular Chetana among many, many. And one is independent, the source of everything. And the other has to take.
The other has to take.
It would be maintained. So we always need supplies. Here in the material world, we need supplies, we need maintenance, and we need substitutes. You follow the supply chain back to the demigods who are providing the universal suppliers. Where they get it from is they get it from the singular being. This is the absolute truth. Where does he get it from? If he gets it from somebody else, you haven't reached there yet. Finally, you reach this unique being. Unique means only one. He supplies and never needs any resupplies. Because if he puts out 100%, he's still got it. That's the difference. That's the absolute truth. He's a unique being. He doesn't need anything. He just is the fountainhead of everything. Right? So, and since everything that we have comes from him, how is it possible to be malicious? it really turns out that if you hate God, if we hate God, we hate ourselves too. Just like if we love God, we begin to love everything and everyone. If we hate God, we hate everything and everyone too. So the alienation from God, we become alienated from reality, we become alienated from other people, we become alienated from ourselves. That's the condition. That's when we begin from the top. Everything begins from the top. So to fix everything, we have to become free from the malicious life. Everyone wants to become God. In the material world, everyone has got a God project going. Everybody wants to be at the top of the food chain or whatever it may be. This malicious nature in competitive sense gratification in the material world, and then up to the point of wanting to be one with the Lord, even if you're a so-called Paramahamsa sannyasi, if you have this idea, you're not a real Paramahamsa because the malicious mind is there. Therefore, the Paramahamsa stage of life can be attained only by those who are fixed in the practice of bhakti yoga. Where one is endeavoring to get rid of this taint. This bhakti yoga begins if a person has the firm conviction that simply discharging devotional service to the Lord in full transcendental love and elevating to the highest affectional stage of life. So that's the beginning. Adho Shraddha. One has to have this, at least this conviction. Because Shraddha, according to Mahaprabhu, the meaning of Shraddha is this firm conviction that if I attain Krishna consciousness, I will accomplish everything. Sarva kama kritaha. Everything else will be taken care of. Right? It's inclusive. So he says here, Brahmaji believed in this art of bhakti yoga. He believed in the instruction of the Lord to execute tapa. And he discharged the function with great penance and thus achieved the great success of seeing Vaikuntha Loka and the Lord also by personal experience. That's Brahma's prototype of performing bhakti yoga. It says you don't need, if people are trying to go by the mechanical means of mind or machine, you can't get there even if you're the greatest muni. Munis who are like bulls among men. Muni Pundava, the great munis, they travel at the speed of mind. And they cannot come close to touching the toes of the lotus feet of Govinda, he says there. And even though they travel at the speed of the air or the mind, that's why Prabhupada's theme, this verse where he says mind or machine. So Brahma didn't travel, he was actually sitting on his lotus seat. And from there, by executing the process of bhakti yoga in great seriousness, he could see the Vaikuntha Lokas with all variegatedness, as well as the Lord in person and his associates. So then Prabhupada reminds us, following in the footsteps of Lord Brahma, any person, even up to this day, can attain the same perfection by following the path of the Paramahamsa as recommended herein. Then he talks about hearing Bhagavatam in the proper way from the right person. And then he says, also because Paramahamsa is usually refers to a sannyas, you know, the different grades of Puttichak, Bhavika, Parivrakacharya, and Paramahamsa, right? These are grades of sannyasis. But he says, one does not need to be in the renounced order of life. He can remain in his present condition. So this Paramahamsa is not necessarily referring to anything but this. He must search out the association of a bona fide devotee of the Lord and hear from him the transcendental message of the Lord with faith and conviction. That is the path of the Paramahamsa recommended herein. And then Prabhupada quotes this verse, a wonderful verse. He is also called Ajita, one who can never be conquered by anyone else. Yet he can be conquered by the Paramahamsa path, as practically realized and shown by the great spiritual master, Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma has personally recommended this Paramahamsa Pantha in his own words as follows. Here's a verse Prabhupada liked very much. Jnane prayasam kapasya manta eva jivanti sanmukaratam bhagadiya vartam stane stita is staying in his own place, you know. Shrutagatam tanuvam manogirye praya soji patitopi asintais chilokam. So jnane prayasam, you know, throw away the process of jnana. Who abandons the path of empiric spiritual speculation engages himself in hearing your glories and activities from a bona fide sadhu or saint. Jivanti sanmukaratam bhavaditi. Yeah, he lives this way, goes on living, hearing offering obeisances to your messages that are spoken by the devotees. Stanes Dita, he stays in his honest life and occupational engagement with social life, can conquer your sympathy and mercy even though you are Jitta or unconquerable. Even though he's conquered, unconquerable by everyone, he becomes in this way conquered by the devotee. That is the path of the Paramahamsas. Well, Brahma spoke this, you can see that
we have a link to that verse right here, people. Yeah. In the 10th canto. Here's the full. Those who, even while remaining situated in their established social positions, throw away the process of speculative knowledge and with their body, words, and mind, as Tanuvat Manopi, offer all respects to descriptions of your personality and activities, dedicating their lives to these narrations, jivanti, they live this way, which are vibrated by you personally or and by your pure devotees. Certainly conquer your lordship, although you are otherwise unconquerable by anyone in the three worlds. Nice verse. So, this is Prabhupada's description here, the Paramahamsa Pantha. Niramatsarana, one has to get rid of that envy, which he says, and malice against the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I have to get over that one. Huh? So now, this beautiful verse here, the word getting very poetic because we have a lot of repetition of the word priya, or variations of it, huh? Tam priya manam. And then the last part, priyam pritamana kares prisham, Prabhupada translates as shaking by the hand. And seeing Brahma present before him, the Lord accepted him as worthy to create living beings, to be controlled as he desires. And thus being very much satisfied with him, the Lord shook hands with Brahma and slightly smiling addressed him thus. So Kareesh Bhishami, he touched them by the hands. They touched hands. And so, the Prabhupada, I think, making this intelligible to Western people, said shaking hands like the business handshake. You know, but wasn't exactly like that. So here, it's very much emphasized in this verse. Priya, who is Krishna, who is beloved, Priyam, Brahma, who loves Krishna, and Prita Manaha, Krishna was very much pleased. And Brahma is called Priyamana, worthy of being dear. He was pleased, Krishna, so Krishna now held him into his heart. So this really emphasizes the very affectionate relationship, mutual relationship of affection between Brahma and Krishna. And then Krishna smiles nicely, and from his smiling face, came up with his speech to Brahma. So now, Prabhupada says, the creation of the material world is not blind or accidental. That is to say, it is made for a purpose. And the purpose is, the living entities who are ever conditioned or nitya-baddha are thus given a chance for liberation under the guidance of his, the Lord's own representative, like Brahma. So Brahma, who creates the universe, is to fulfill the purpose which he also takes part in of saving the living entities. That's what the whole thing is for. That the whole purpose of creation is the deliverance of living entities.
The Lord instructs Brahma in Vedic knowledge in order to diffuse this knowledge to the conditioned souls. Prabhupada points out that the Vedas are delivered when the universe is created. He compares it to the fact that when you buy a computer or any piece of technology, you get an operator's manual with it. So here's the universe. What are we supposed to do? Does it have a purpose? Does it have a meaning? We look around us. What are we doing here? We can't figure it out. You start to try to figure it out by your own efforts. You'll just keep on going and going and going and going, and you'll never know what the result is. I was once in a gathering. When I was in graduate school. I was in the Department of Religion, and I walking across campus, and I see this sign, and it said there was a fellow coming to speak in the physics department, visiting professor from Yeshiva University, in the physics department, and the title of his lecture was called Atman, Brahman, and von Neumann. Von Neumann is a famous mathematician who had something to do with mathematics of physics. I can't remember now exactly what the kind of name was. Atman, Brahman, and von Neumann. So I took this poster and I happened to be walking over to the religion department, and in the department, the religion department, there's a lounge, and at the lounge are sitting various professors and graduate students. And I just, you know, just looked at it and said, hey, look at this. Look what they're doing in the physics department. This is our territory. And so people got all excited. And so the lecture was just happening in, you know, half an hour. So a whole bunch of us went from the religion department to the physics department. And it was really funny because we were like people from different planets. I mean, after we said hello and the weather's nice, nobody knew what to say with each other. And so then we sat in this lecture hall, and this guy came, and the first thing he did was apologize that really he's really going to talk about von Neumann, and he doesn't have much to say about Atman and Brahman. He just thought it was a kind of catchy title. There was some connection, I can't remember what, some very vague connection about von Neumann's mathematical speculation. I can't remember what it was now. There's some vague connection. Anyway, so he gave this talk, and then there's a question and answer session, and people from the religion department and the physics department, they thought they ought to say something to each other, you know. So at one point, this one professor from the religion department stood up, and he made this big, sweeping statement. I always thought he was what we call technically a BS artist, but you know, he said about the meaning of life and the cosmos. You know, he made these big, broad statements like that. And so he sat down, and then this guy from the physics department stood up. I think he was a graduate student. He's very young. He says, "How can you say things like that? How can you make these big statements?" He says, "We don't even understand a chromium atom. We don't even understand how water flows through a pipe." But that was like a really great statement to me. That's right. I mean, here we are in the world. We have to find our way around. We have to do something with our lives. Time is short. We have this feeling we got to do something. And you're going to go to science to find out what's going on? They don't even understand how water flows through a pipe. Because the mathematics of that flow is very, very complicated. People are working on it to figure it out. And the guy is probably writing his doctoral dissertation on the chromium atom. Particularly frustrated by that. So how long is it going to take to figure it out? You're going to wait until the evidence is in. What is the world? What is it about you? That's our situation. But here, what actually happens is Brahma creates the world for a purpose, and he gives us the manual what to do with it. What's it for? We take the manual and we use it. Prabhupada compared the material scientists to people like to a man who's been given an automobile to take a journey. And he's driving along, and he's this is an amazing automobile. This is really quite far out. Pulls over the side of the road. This opens the hood, the bonnet, you know, begins to look inside. This is fascinating. And he gets so absorbed in the automobile, he never takes the journey. So here, the Vedic knowledge is given to diffuse this to the conditioned soul because he creates the Brahmanas. The Brahmanas are the people who can understand the Vedic knowledge. That's what a Brahmana is. And in this way, it is supposed to be passed down. This is part of his job. The conditioned souls are forgetful souls in their relationship with the Lord, and thus a period of creation and the process of dissemination of Vedic knowledge are necessary activities of the Lord. Lord Brahma has a great responsibility in delivering the conditioned souls, and therefore he's very dear to the Lord. So far, at least from reading this text, we see that, you know, he's engaged in the business of creation. But now Prabhupada points out that the real reason he's really dear to the Lord is because of his responsibility in delivering the conditioned souls, which is really the point of creation anyway. Brahma does his duty very perfectly, not only by generating living entities, but also by spreading his party for reclaiming the fallen souls. This party is called the Brahma Sampradaya, or the Sankirtan party. And any member of this party to date is naturally engaged in reclaiming the fallen souls back to Godhead, back home. The Lord is very much anxious to get back his parts and parcels, and as stated in the Bhagavad Gita, no one is more dear to one than one who takes the task of reclaiming the fallen souls back to Godhead. So this is where Prabhupada takes us from this idea of being very dear to Krishna. And so he says this at the end of the Bhagavad Gita. And then there's a very interesting word here. There are many renegades from the Brahma Sampradaya, whose only business is to make men more forgetful. You know this word renegade? I got it up here for you in the dictionary. And the original first meaning, this is the Oxford English Dictionary, which gave you the history of the usage of words. The first meaning, an apostate from any form of religious faith. So one who turns against or betrays a religious faith is called an apostate. Especially a Christian who becomes a Muslim. That was the first usage of this word, renegade, coming from the Spanish renegado. An apostate. One who deserts a party, person, or principle in favor of another. A turncoat. A traitor. That's the name. So I don't know exactly whether he's suggesting. Then he says here, when he gets to the renegades, such persons are never dear to the Lord, unlike Brahma. The renegades from the Brahma Sampradaya is different to make people more forgetful of the Lord and entangle them more and more. And it's just the opposite. And then he says the Lord sends them deeper into the darkest regions of matter so that such envious demons may not be able to know the Supreme Lord. I don't know exactly.
Yeah, what is it? That's like
that everybody, all the demons, or some of them, who are the renegades from the Brahma Sampradaya? It's a very interesting idea.
That phrase there, sent in deeper into the darkest region of matter, is reminiscent of the Isha Upanishad, where Prabhupada said that, you know, the so-called learners are even worse than the...
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right. It is.
In fact, Mother's commentary on that verse is that those who know Vidya but don't preach it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's what Mother said?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's wonderful. Great.
So anyway, they're the renegades from the Brahma Sampradaya. This is a really interesting expression. But maybe we all, you know, anyway, but their business is, I don't know if this is in a very general sense or a very particular sense. Anyone, however, preaching the mission of the Lord in the line of the Brahma Sampradaya, so Prabhupada is now talking to his disciples, is always dear to the Lord, and the Lord, being satisfied with such a preacher of the authorized book he called, shakes hands with him in great satisfaction. Prabhupada really brings home the fact that what happens with Brahma is very intimately related with us. That we have this connection with this kind of originating incident of the enlightenment of Brahma, and as followers in our sampradaya, we should follow the same path, the Paramahamsa Putta, and if we do like we're supposed to do, the Lord will also shake hands with us in great satisfaction. It's quite a wonderful reward. Anything else? Yeah, question?
You said that the Vedas was like the manual that came with the creation of the universe. So I guess back then it was more like text support because they didn't have anything written down. More of a text support type thing?
They didn't have to write it down because they heard it and they knew it.
Right.
See, now we have hard drives, then we had memories. So the text support of the Brahmanas, I suppose, who understand all this stuff. You can ask them and they know. But actually, the fact is that the Vedas came down through Lord Brahma. They're present in the world. And the people that heard it remembered it. It just didn't need to be written down. Writing is a sign of the decline of civilization, not advancement. A higher literacy.
In the discussion about malice, the impersonal is also kind of malice.
Yeah, malice, right.
But when he achieves perfection, liberation, he's beyond the modes. So it's curious how someone beyond the modes can still have malice, which is normally associated with the moral modes.
Well, because he doesn't really go there. He doesn't really go there. There's two descriptions of impersonalists. One is the Brahma body, and the other is the Maya body. Now, the Brahma body is not really malicious. He is attracted to or absorbed in Brahman. But when it comes to the Lord, he has no hostile feelings. And recognizes that the Lord is a transcendental personality, but just his level of understanding or his realization is, you know, the Brahman. They tend to be very close to Shanti or Rasa, neutrality, passive adoration. That's kind of a borderline situation. Sometimes our acharyas don't count it as a Rasa, because there's no active interaction. But anyway, that's the Brahma body. Whereas the Maya body, what the Maya body is the teaching that Krishna is Maya. Now that's malice. That's hostility. And Bhakti Siddhanta says about those, they take birth as stones or trees because of being so greedy. But that's not the Brahma Jyoti.
Yeah. Is there any use in preaching to these kinds of Maya bodies who have that mentality? That many people in the West doing book distribution have this malice mentality.
Yeah, definitely. One way or the other. Yeah.
So
you mean in the sense of Brahma, I am going to become God? Well, how you preach to them, there's a whole thing, you know. You have to deal with the individuals and see where you can get a foothold on them about this. I think I'm pretty convinced that on philosophical grounds, you can show that Mayavada doesn't hold water. Of course, see, many of these people, you cannot argue to them on the basis of Shastri, they don't even know about it. And then sometimes you have to use his various, you know, people are just stupid. Like, I have one guy came to my temple once and he was a devotee in our congregation or something. He went off to some yoga camp. And he came back and he said to me, "Words are meaningless." So I said, "Shut up." And then he tried to insist that words are meaningless. If they're meaningless, shut up. I said, "Your philosophy is so stupid you can't even speak it." You just have to get a hold of somebody where you can. But ultimately, sometimes you have to get down to people about. I'll tell you how the malice with God is mostly, I've seen it, is people say, "I don't believe in God." And I say, "Well, why don't you describe to me the God you don't believe in?" Then they give a description, and I can always say, "I don't believe in that God either." and then they're all inquisitive. I say, "You know, here's what we think. Here's what God is really like. What you've described is a kind of a demon, and that's not God." Because you really find out that especially in the West, people are really angry with God all the time. And you find that you have to deal with people with their anger at God. One thing that's useful to point out, if they say that God doesn't exist, and then you start talking about the God that doesn't exist, they have real anger. Now, how can you be angry at somebody who doesn't exist? You know, their anger is almost a testimony to their covert theism. Because it's a live, virulent anger. I don't believe, you know, if you're really super confident that there's no God, you wouldn't bother to be angry. You wouldn't have any feelings toward God whatsoever, one way or other. Those are the really hard people to deal with. They just somehow their spiritual nerve has been cut out or something. I don't know. But anyway, so then you can start talking about what their idea of God is. And you know, then there are many ideas that they think that God is not a person. A lot of times, it's just because you're speculating. And any time you try to speculate about transcendence, you end up thinking of negativity. You know, you have the idea of this body. The body is what it is. It grows old. So God certainly, the body is limited. So God is, you know, he's not, he has no form. People don't like other people. Their usual experience with persons as a whole is fairly nasty. So the idea that God could be a person, they don't want to deal with people anymore. They don't want God to be a person. If he's a person, he's all powerful. He must be like their boss. He must be like Joseph Stalin or somebody like that. You know, they have these ideas. And you could just start to say, you know, this is your idea, but actually it's possible. Anyway, start somewhere. Yeah?
I think a lot of devotees come kind of through an impersonalist kind of stage before they come to devotion.
Yeah, and Prabhupada did say, there's no harm in being a Mayavadi if you haven't heard about Krishna. No, I was a philosopher. One of these guys who went to college looking for the truth. And people, you just got laughed at. And my first philosophy course, we were asked, what is philosophy? We're all raising our hands like idiots. And the guy calls on different people and he writes our answers on the board. And I said, philosophy means asking questions like, who am I, where have I come from, where am I going? And he kind of smirked, and he wrote it on the board. And then he went through and he demolished every answer. Right? And he came to mind, and he says, oh, yes. He was from England. He was, Oh, yes.
We have one person in this department who, anyway, asks these questions. Who am I? Where have I come from? Where am I going? I answer, my name is Kim Young. I am coming from College Hall, and I am going to Bennett Hall. And he went, struck out. This is the philosophy and the style of demolition, you know. So hostile. I mean, you couldn't talk about it. I mean, there were just certain things you were not allowed to talk about. They were not valid questions. So I got brainwashed for a while on that one. But then, you know, just by kind of trying to understand the foundations and the limits of material knowledge, I came to a position where it took me up to the edge of Buddhism. And I thought that, anyway, that there were some Western philosophers who were kind of bumped into Buddhism. I began to read Buddhistic literature. And I began to get interested in that. Because I was a nihilist, right? So there's the void out there, there's nothingness. You can call it the profane void, but in Buddhism there's a void, but somehow it's the sacred void. there's some kind of change, you know. So then I got into Buddhist stuff, and then I decided to study Buddhism because all these guys in the philosophy department hated religion, so there must be something to it. And I went to a university so I could study all different religions. And so I was pretty much into Buddhism. And then I started to study some Hinduism stuff. I took a lot of Hinduism courses. As I said, they're all taught by Mayavadis. But I got interested in Shankara. And for some reason or other, you know, from Buddha, I went to Shankara. I went to Shankaracharya. And I was really into Shankaracharya. And then I began to figure out there was something wrong with the way I was being taught Shankaracharya. If you want to know, I'll try to explain. Shankaracharya sets up a system of thought that ultimately is self-destructive. And anyway, in the system of thought, he has a contrast. Nirguna Brahman and Saguna Brahman. Saguna Brahman is the god we worship. And who's the object of ignorance. And then there's Nirguna Brahman, right, who was... So there's these two kind of ideas of this, of Saguna and Nirguna Brahman. And then we're supposed to rise to the idea of beyond duality. But then I realized that if you have this contrast, Nirguna and Saguna Brahman, that itself is a duality. And if I choose Nirguna Brahman by rejecting Saguna Brahman, which I thought everybody's saying you're supposed to do, that you've only got one half of the picture. You know, you're still in the realm of duality. And then I figured the real Brahman has to be somehow Saguna and Nirguna at the same time. I don't know what that was. But that's what it had to be, and the whole philosophy of Shankara, based on this these contrasting between vidya and avidya, had to be thrown away. That's what I thought. And then when I finally met the devotees and I began to understand something about the idea of Krishna, I said, that's what he's talking about. That's what Shankara is talking about. So then when I was first going to the temple, we had a really harsh temple president at that time. He was a really hard-nosed guy. And almost every lecture he was blasting my philosophy. Especially because at that time there was a guy named Amrit Desai in my city, in Philadelphia, who was a yoga teacher. Later he became a big guru teaching Shaktipat Kundalini Yoga.
and he got quite wealthy and famous, and then he was discovered, you know, messing around with money and women. He met Prabhupada late in his career as a big yogi, and Prabhupada warned him against the dangers of illicit sex. There's a tape that's in Bombay. But anyways, by that time I was just teaching yoga, just a simple yoga teacher. And he would come to the temple with his yoga students. And whenever he came, our temple president would start, you know, the whole lecture was just blasting Mayavadis and blasting Shankaracharya. So I was afraid to ask questions, because if you ask a question, you get chewed up. But I went. I went to him after the class, and I said, you know, I said, and I was really expecting to get. I wouldn't do it in public, but off to the side. You know, I said, I know what's wrong with Mayavada philosophy, but I've been studying Shankaracharya, and I think that Shankaracharya is really a devotee. And I was waiting to get hit. I know. He said, "You're right." He said, "He's Lord Shiva, and he's the greatest devotee of Krishna, and so on like that." So I really believe that Shankaracharya, if you really understand him, you'll become a devotee. But most people, they just have this philosophy in their head like a chunk of bricks, and they never quite understand. They get to the point of that if you really understand it, you throw it away, and you should become a devotee. I really think that's built in. So that was my experience. I mean, I really went from sort of materialism to Buddhism, Buddhism to Shankaracharya, Shankaracharya Krishna consciousness, and then when I finally got to read Prabhupada's books, I said, you know, this is discussed. This kind of it's a sort of a natural progression that way. So that's why so many people come. They're Mayavadis. I mean, I became a Mayavadi, I guess, in a way, when I was about 14 years old, when I started thinking about the nature of infinity or something, and having no limits, and then if their affinity means there's no limit, then to think that God is a person is to already think of something limited, so he can't be a person. I mean, I just figured that out by myself. And I go to church and I feel all sorry for all these people. They didn't understand. So it's just a natural way of speculating up to a certain point. Now, because everybody speculates like that, and everybody comes to the same point. You know, there's books written like called the Perennial Philosophy. I guess it was Aldous Huxley. Yeah, he wrote this book. It was famous, big in one time, called The Perennial Philosophy. Basically going through the mystical literature of the world and finding the same Mayavada thing one way or another in personalism. And because it was all over everywhere, he thought it was perennial. But I mean, sense gratification is perennial too. It doesn't mean it's the truth. It's just another thing. So everybody can speculate their way to impersonalism, and they usually do. But it's just incomplete. It's just you have to keep on. It's inadequate. We have to show people this. Yeah.
On this topic of maliciousness against God, mm-hmm. Sometimes I wonder that the reason why we have to approach God through a devotee or through a spiritual master is part of the remedy to get over the maliciousness.
Yeah.
In other words, like we can't directly jump and try to worship God directly. You know, we are repeatedly told to go through the devotee, yeah, and then to worship a devotee as if he's God.
Well, it's just that it's funny that people who still have some maliciousness to God can develop some affection for devotees, and devotees become attracted to people because actually it's because they reflect some divine qualities. And because of that, people become attracted to them. And then their idea that maybe there's such a thing as a person who's not a priest, who's not out to use me, abuse me, you know, and so on. Like we've discovered in the world, and we've really got no interest in self-helping me out. And you know, this is a different kind of person. And then who are these people worshiping? Why are they like this? How do they get like this? Remember, whenever you're going to people to get them to become devotees, what we are saying and what they're thinking of, if we're not thinking of, they're saying, I should become just like them. Do I want to do that? I remember this young man wanted to be a devotee, and he moved in the temple with his wife, who didn't. And he thought, well, exposure, and she'll become attractive. And she never did. And I tried to talk to her because she wanted to take her husband with her. So I talked about the devotees, and she had this irrefutable argument. You're just creeps. You're just too weird. You bald heads, and you know, I just couldn't. The idea that you're creeps.
I couldn't refute it.
What can you say? I'm not a creep. When our devotees are nice, she just had this emotional reaction of aversion to devotees. She didn't like anything. She didn't like the haircut. She didn't like the clothes. She didn't like. She just thought we were weird. I don't think she used the word creep. I think that's just kept saying, you're just weird. You're just weird. You know? Just couldn't relate anyway. I don't know, what can you say? But those are extreme cases like that. People are either attracted or they're not. Hemal Krishna showed me something once that was really nice. In the early days of the Radha Damodar Party was first getting started, he and Vishnujanand Swami had one bus. And at that time they were doing this thing. It was before they went into book distribution, and with this one bus, they would set up on college campuses, and they came to Philadelphia for a short visit, but the bus broke down, and it was kind of an antique bus, and they had to wait a while to get the parts to fix it. So they were there for almost a month, I think, parked right outside the temple. And so I made arrangements for them to do their thing at the local universities, to set up on campus like they did, and I would go out with them. You know, they had a bhajan band, Vishnujanand singing, and they had an ektar and a sarangi, and the tape's still around. It's a great bhajan tape, you know, and Vishnujanand singing. And they would set up there with a little stage, and they would chant. And then they had some tables, and they serve out prasada. Every day they take out the same thing, you know, a potato sabji, some halva, some puris and a drink. That's the take on every day and set at the table and they play. And college students would come and sit down and start eating and listening to the bhajans. And they also had kindergarten rhythm instruments that other people wanted to play along. You know, they had little bells to ring and clocks to hit. And the devotees, they did this cool thing that they had an ektar. You know, this is like a gourd, and it has a single string. Bung 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 bung. You dump a mic in there. Bung 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 bung. And they had everything mic. They had car batteries, you know, truck batteries, and so there's amplification. And they take the mic onto a tambura. And they even had a mic on the harmonium, you know. And so it didn't matter if other people had little blocks or things, they didn't disturb them. Anyway, people would sit and listen. And the Tamal Krishna Goswami showed me what he did. He would go around to everybody, the kids would be sitting, and he would say, how do you like the music? How do you like the food? And if they were not interested, they'd say, it's okay. He'd go on to the next person. He said, don't waste your time. When somebody's interested, that's a person you can talk to. So this was like the first test. You know, if they were, if some attraction was there, they liked, then he would spend time talking to them. Otherwise, don't waste your time. And so after I was doing that, after he left, I set up the same thing and was doing it for quite some time, the same kind of program. And I tried it one time. Somebody was really not interested, and I sat and I talked to this guy, and he finally said to me, he said, "Look," he says, I can't answer your arguments, but I'm just not interested." And I said, "Right, you got nothing you can do." I proved to him that there's, you cannot be happy in the material world. There's no way. You can, no way you can argue against it. But he just wasn't interested in anything else. That's one thing, is you should not waste, we should not waste our energy. You should find some people who are favorable somehow or other. Okay, it's gotten late now, huh? So we'll continue tomorrow. Thank you, Srila Prabhupada.